Here on FM, in our new Book of the Week, Reaching Down the Rabbit Hole, the leading clinical neurologist and Harvard professor, Alan Roper, describes some of the most unusual case studies in his extraordinary career. We begin by joining him on his speed rounds at the neurological unit of the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston.
Hello, I'm Dr. Alan Roper. How are you? That's a grammatical question. Plus and minus. Is your mind clear? I guess so. There are a lot of unexplained issues around me, but I'm communicating appropriately. His name is Dr. Vandermeer. He is in his mid-80s, and he is a genuine Boston Brahmin. I know his type well. Over the past 50 years, he has built a national reputation as a top-drawer researcher and a caring physician, universally admired, all the while taking somewhat heedless care of his own body. When he retired in his 70s, he settled upon a daily routine that failed to anticipate his declining faculties. He is as unwilling to accept this fact as he is to acknowledge the unruliness of his eyebrows or his surplus of nose and ear hair, a clinical indifference that is not unusual in aging doctors. You know where you are? At Brigham and Women's Hospital. The date?
The date? No, I couldn't give you that.
Doc Vandermeer was brought here over his own objections after his wife found him sitting on the toilet some 7 hours after he had ventured from bedroom to bathroom. He had spent the night there. Have you had any hallucinations?
I don't think so, but then people generally don't.
Touché. Have you had any convulsions?
No.
And you know about this meningioma in your right temporal lobe? You have a meningioma there about the size of a lemon. Were you aware of that?
I've had two growth issues that are pertinent. One is in the pancreas, the other is there.
But you seem a little off cognitively, and our struggle is, could it be the meningioma that's doing it?
As they say, that's your problem.
He's right. It is my problem. It is my job to parse his convoluted responses, fit them into the clinical picture, prioritize his issues, and come up with a plan that lets him live the life he wants to live to the extent that is possible. He knows that he has a benign tumor in his pancreas that poses less of a threat than the meningioma in his brain. The brain tumor will not kill him anytime soon, but it will continue to diminish his powers of thought. We'll find out what's what and let you know, I say. Great to meet you. It will take us some time to sort it all out, but this is a start. Hannah, my senior resident, gives me a nod, signaling it's time to move on to the next patient. Hello there. I'm Dr. Roper, one of the neurologists. And you've met Hannah Ross, our chief resident. Do you mind if we talk to you? His name is Gary, and he is one unhappy customer. He is 32 years old, and has spent more time in hospitals than he cares to recall. How are you doing? I ask.
I can function, Gary replies listlessly, but not to design specifications.
Interesting phrase. Where did you get that from?
Gene Roddenberry.
It fits. Gary is a computer programmer who has so immersed himself in Star Trek that he knows the starship design specifications by heart. He has had epilepsy since childhood, culminating in the surgical removal of part of his brain when he was 17. A U-shaped scar stands out prominently on the left side of his close-cropped scalp. He has enough experience with his condition to know when he needs to go to the hospital, although he would rather not have to go.
As I understand, you had several events yesterday, Hannah says. A lot of seizures?
Well, not many for me. What's considered many?
It all depends on how many is many for you. I was under the impression that you did have many for you, in a row. Is that not true?
No. Even when I have clusters, it's probably 4 or 5.
Is that what you had yesterday? 4 or 5?
Well, that's not what brought me to the hospital, if that's what you're getting at. Gary is in a mood.
So I'm happy to let Hannah carry the ball. This is her ward. These are her patients. I am the attending physician, and while I took the lead with Dr. Vandermeer in deference to his stature, I now take up a position at the foot of the bed and watch. That is what I'm getting at, Hannah continues, in a sing-song tone as if trying to engage a curious child. So, what brought you to the hospital today?
I had a really bad headache, and I was feeling very tired. I was clumsy, and I couldn't stand up straight, and my hands were vibrating.
And that's not what usually happens with your seizures?
Well, I don't get so much warning with the seizures, although some days I can tell if I'm walking up to the edge of a seizure, but it doesn't always lead to a seizure.
How many seizures do you usually have in a given day?
There's no usual. Some days I have none. Some days I have a lot.
But say in the course of a month.
You keep wanting me to do that. You keep wanting me to put some pattern to it. Believe me, I wish I could put a pattern to it. Would you like to see my seizure log?
That won't be necessary.
Gary is exasperated to the point of annoyance, almost anger, without the emotional edge to attain real anger. It's as though he has programmed himself to be confrontational, but the confrontational part of his brain is so compromised that he can't run the code.
It's time for us to get going again. It was really great to meet you, I say. I wish the rest of our patients had your outlook.
You mean felt that there's nothing you guys can do?
No. I mean had your level of self-awareness.
Gary is wrong that there's nothing we can do, but he's right about one thing. His mind is not working to design specifications. Although in that regard, he is hardly unique. There are 29 other people on the ward right now who could say the same thing.
They call this place the Brigham, short for Brigham and Women's Hospital. It is part of an enclave of teaching hospitals serving as a training ground for Harvard's medical students. At clinics and community hospitals throughout New England, whenever a doctor looks over a patient chart, sighs, and says, "Send it to Boston," there is a good chance that the patient will end up here. It is a place where the strangest and most challenging cases are sent, cases whose complexity would tax the resources of smaller hospitals. I'm a clinical neurologist and a professor of neurology. Most people have little idea what that means, but among other things, it means that I am an authority on what the brain does right and does wrong. The practice of my craft, the clinical part of it, is the systematic, logical, deductive method that was, in the past, applicable to all branches of medicine, but now resides mainly in neurology. The paradoxical part of it is that my primary sources of information, my patients' brains, are quite often altered, sometimes bizarrely, as a result of disease. This creates an incredible and self-referential conundrum. How do you begin to understand a sick brain? The only viable answer is that you do it by engaging the person inside, and you do it on a case-by-case basis.
He hasn't felt emotion for at least a month.
This is the girlfriend speaking. She is in her mid-30s, as is her boyfriend, the man without emotion. They have lived together for 5 years. They have a child. They are resigned to their fate.
What do you mean by that? I ask her.
He may smile, nothing else.
In speaking to you, speaking to each other?
No, he really hasn't initiated a conversation in the last month.
That's typical for a butterfly glioma infiltrating the frontal lobes, I say, referring to his spreading, malignant brain tumor. I turn to him.
Can you tell us a joke, Dennis?
Hopefully not, he replies with little effect.
Dennis seems indifferent, even when he grins. His head is shaved, and his cranial stubble reveals the dark shadow of a receding hairline. He has a tattoo on his left forearm in Gothic text that reads, "Sick."
There's enough rattling around in there so that your thinking seems really good.
Yeah, he says. What's missing? What's not right in your head, I say.
Dennis pauses, inhales deeply through his nostrils, thinks about it, but says nothing.
You have trouble expressing yourself in language or expressing yourself in emotion?
He takes his time.
I think it's in emotion.
To the girlfriend again.
I understood from the residents that there's a conversation going on about hospice.
I'm thinking maybe we can bring him home and have hospice come in, she says.
Can you behave yourself if you go home? I say to Dennis. He grins and shakes his head. No? So this is some combination of the tumor and his character. I mean, you are a character, Dennis, right? His grin springs from memory more than feeling. He knows that it's only a matter of months. The irony is that the location of the tumor has neutralized the part of his brain that would allow him to care. So, he was a character, but not so much anymore. What Dennis, his girlfriend, and everybody else on the ward need, more than anything else, is to tell us their stories. What they hope, what they expect, what they deserve, is that we take the time to listen. Because the act of listening is therapeutic in itself. When we do it right, we learn details that make us better doctors for the next patient. The residents may not get this yet. They are focused on diagnosis and treatment, on technology, on scales, doses, ratios, elevations, and deficiencies. All well and good, I tell them, but don't forget to listen. Hannah and the team are huddled around a computer monitor in a cubbyhole near the nurse's station on the 10th floor. They have made it through medical school and earned their MDs, chosen to go into neurology, and this is now finishing school for them. My role is to look over their shoulders and challenge their assumptions. As they play at the computer, a patient sits 20 feet away, just beyond a glass door and curtains. He was admitted 3 hours ago with a sudden onset of a speech difficulty and a complete personality change. The team hasn't visited him yet. Instead, they are transfixed by the images of his brain up on the screen. What I want is for them to step away from the monitor and into the room, sit by the bed, talk to the patient, and examine the man instead of his pixels. But for now, the team is still learning about the brain, if not the entire nervous system, observing up close the ways it can malfunction. In time, they will figure out how to interact with the person inside the brain. They will find their comfort level with the families. Someday, they will be the ones who have to tell a patient that nothing will ever be the same. Speed rounds are over, and I'm in the elevator, bearing coffee on my way to 10 South, where Hannah is waiting, patient list in hand. As we walk through, she exchanges the patient list for the coffee cup I hold out to her, and I ask the question I have asked countless times. So, what have we got?
Reaching Down the Rabbit Hole was written by Alan Ropper and Brian Burrell. It was abridged by Pete Nichols and read by Colin Stinton. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. Tomorrow, Dr. Ropper's case studies include a man whose good humour is a symptom of his illness. So what's coming up on Woman's Hour after the news? Well, a new advertising campaign from Sport England to get more women playing sport. Domestic violence perpetrator programme Stop Abuse, says new research. Nail biting is very common, but why do we do it? And does it matter? Laura Doggett, a hotly tipped 2015 musician, plays live. And why is Denmark said to be the happiest place to live in the world? Woman's Hour with Jane Garvey is in a couple of minutes.
Returning to BBC Radio 4, the series in which broadcasters follow their personal passions and talk to people whose stories interest them most.
They put it to us that really, because we're a different face, we couldn't be happy together, which has turned out to be untrue.
One to One, exploring mixed marriage and Britain's changing communities.
The difference between the economic level and the social level of people on this side of the road and the other side of the road is almost obscene. So, yeah, I can understand young people being angry.
One to One returns tomorrow morning at 9:30 and then available on the BBC Radio 4 website.